Well, I know that it can't have been easy for you up here, what with all the murder and the dirt.
This is the Extra Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 292 for the April 13th, 2024 weekend. I am Pip-Boy Boy, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Tire Toilet, Sarah D. Bunting.
The future is nah.
And basically the mother of the groom, Tara Ariano.
Everyone knows who I am, but do they know who they are? Welcome to Extra Extra Hot Great for another week, and thank you so much for being here. We love you. We treasure you. We are thrilled to bring you this bonus episode. Our lead topic this weekend, fallout, in which 219 years after a nuclear attack obliterated Los Angeles and presumably the rest of the country and world, descendants of the survivors are living in an elaborate network of underground fallout shelters, each governed by an overseer. To mix up the gene pool, eligible residents apply to be married to residents of neighboring vaults and meet their matches only on their wedding day. Vault 33's Lucy McLean, Ella Purnell from Yellowjackets, is thrilled when her fiancé, Monty, Cameron Cooperthwaite, turns out to be very hot, if a little laconic, but neither here nor the delegation from Vault 32 is exactly what they seem. On the surface, humans who weren't lucky enough to be born in the vaults have found ways to band together for protection, but no solution is perfect. I don't know either of these series co-creators who adapted it from the series of video games of the same name, but two of the executive producers here are Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, formerly of Westworld. All 8 episodes dropped on Prime Video on Wednesday, April 10th. We will avoid spoilers before event series premiere. Let's do the Chen check-in. Sarah, should our listeners watch Fallout?
Yes.
Wow. Dave.
Yeah, after I got past the first episode, I really enjoyed it.
Okay, well, I only watched the first episode, and then Dave was like, I think you'd like it. So I guess I'm going to trust Dave, and I will continue watching as well. Let's get into it. Last year, we talked about Silo, based on a book. This year, we have Fallout, based on a video game. Which kind of media would we say has provided the richer source material for an exploration of what life might be like for people surviving nuclear war by living underground? Dave, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, the motivations of the Silo of Silo and the vaults of Fallout are similar, like similar in universe, but this show, Fallout, avoids getting bogged down in sort of the muck that Silo did with its why the Silo? Like,
right.
Why the vault is because, oops, upstairs is bad and yeah, we're going to deal with our own shit down here, asterisk. But everything about Fallout is more fun, lighter, dumber, airier than Silo was. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, on the surface, they seem like similar concepts. But once you dig in, you see the differences pretty quick.
Sarah, I'm shocked to hear you recommend this. How did they get you?
It's not perfect. But first of all, it did have a lighter feel, like Dave said. Second of all, the grace notes of world building that they chose to include, but then not really like stand back too performatively from, to be all like, look how beautifully we did this. Like the way that they all signed the wedding gown in Sharpie.
I like that too.
Was beautiful, but not, it wasn't like too, not fraught, but you know what I mean. I feel like the same detail in Silo, there would have been someone crooning hallelujah at an even lower speed than usual. And it's like, okay, just guys, try to find some joy in what these characters might find joy in. And I think that is what sets it apart from Silo and certain other dystopian projects that I haven't cared for, which is like characters would be able to find joy and lightness and happiness, even if it doesn't seem to us on the outside like they would be, or that would not be the like dominant mood. There are certain sequences and parts of the various timelines that don't work as well for me, that the characters are not as compelling and it's too slow. They're way, way too reliant on mid-century needle drops. Like, oh my God, we get it. Your music budget is all the money. Great work. But overall, I found it really watchable, and that they could start out with that still, to me, chilling opener of these bombs hitting, and then be in this kind of like perky conception of what how life might have continued centuries later, I thought was really well done and interesting enough that I wanted to keep going.
I thought the opening, while expensive looking and harrowing in its own way, was sort of a misstep, actually, because watching the rest of the series, I thought like the opening was a different sort of tone than what we got after. Like, the opening is not at all mirthful or winky. It's just this scene of Walter Goggins' pre-apocalypse character. He's like a cowboy movie star in this world where the 60s and 50s sort of became the dominant pop culture everything in their alternate timeline or whatever's going on here. So it is like well into the 2070s. But everything looks like the early 60s.
Yeah.
But like they've got, and it's weird because they got like floating robots that help you at home. But all the TVs are still black and white cathode ray tubes. Like it's a lot of weird, just, you know, choices like that, that make the universe look the way it does. But that whole opening where he's at this kid's party doing his shtick, it's like kind of mean-spirited and kind of a downer. But then like after the first episode ends, which probably like they put too much place setting work load on the first episode, given that the rest of the series does happily switch timelines and characters at a moment's whim, they could have spread that out a bit more. There's no reason why we couldn't start off in the wastelands, in the post-apocalyptic universe, and just get there and like you're in the vault to start, what the fuck's going on kind of thing. Probably would have been a better choice. So that is to say, if you had the same reaction to the first episode as I did, which was, this seems like nobody's having enough fun, it gets there.
Yeah.
And it gets there relatively quick. And yes, this is from the Westworld people, so it does suffer from a 5-pound show and a 10-pound bag syndrome that all of these kind of things do.
I felt like it was more like 8.5 pounds of show.
You're right.
So
my math is off. I would agree with your math there. It does get pretty funny and gross pretty quick. And I did enjoy that. And the mystery box aspects of it, like, you know, what's really going on in the vault? It's on par with Silo, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, you know, who's just the big baddie that is the megalomaniac that knows how the world should operate. It's almost the same story as Silo. Once you get into it, that doesn't matter because there's like 12-foot robot knights going around squishing people's heads with their hands just for shits and giggles. Like, there's just a lot of crazy stuff. Walter Goggins is good. And the other thing about the first episode is that there's two other main characters. There's Lucy, that's the female lead, and there's Maximus, that's the male lead. And Maximus isn't in the vault. He is part of this paramilitary quasi-religious sect.
Shaolin.
Brotherhood of Steel.
Yes, the Brotherhood of Steel. They got the mech suits. And when you are introduced to them, they have this like very narrow worldview because they've been siloed in their worlds, one in a vault, one in this brotherhood. And their characters seem really kind of flat and, oh no, these might not be good actors. But then as the show opens up, the characters change really quickly as they start experiencing the real world. You're like, oh shit, that was good acting. Yay. You know what I mean? That was kind of a surprise.
Yeah.
I thought Maximus was going to be a dud, but actually he's good.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that it's not.
Yeah, because that kind of character is usually not that dynamic. But once he pairs up with Lucy, he really comes out of his shell. So that small world one-noteness is also a problem with the first episode. That is not a problem moving forward.
Interesting.
Again, my takeaway is watch at least two if you're at all interested in this sort of mayhem, because two will get you to the tone that will carry you through until episode 8.
Yeah. Well, to that point, considering that a Walton Goggins character who is missing his nose is most of what has been selling this project ahead of time, did it take too long for us to get to him?
He starts off as this cowboy character in the past.
Yes.
You know, as Fallout is told. And then he becomes the ghoul, which is the version of him that has a nose. And I don't understand why all the ghouls, and the ghouls are a type of person in the future. Like, there's vault dwellers, there's surface dwellers, there's ghouls that have been treated with some medicine that basically turns them into Deadpool, where they can heal really fast, but they ugly.
Right.
But they all lose their nose, but they don't explain why the nose is missing. Maybe that's a big thing in season two, mystery of the missing noses.
Well, In the pilot, they say he's been buried underground and like someone digs him up once a year and cuts a piece off him. So I don't know if they just start with the nose to spite their face. I don't know.
Oh,
there are scenes later in the show where there are multiple ghouls and they all are missing. They all look like they're coke fiends, you know, to the extreme. And then there's that's another one. There's fiends. Those are the cannibals of the universe.
Okay.
But anyway, so he's a ghoul now in the Fallout version of the Fallout portion of Fallout. But, you know, he's still a family man at heart. He's a fun character, but honestly, I thought he was going to carry the show.
Yeah.
But by the midpoint of the show, the three leads they're all doing it, which is surprising to me, especially with a Walter Goggins involved.
Yeah. I also will say a character like Lucy has a high potential to be annoying, but I personally felt like the creators did a good job of avoiding a lot of the usual strong female character tropes. And that might just be in like making her kind of horny to start out with, because I enjoyed that in the pilot. Sarah, what were your feelings about Lucy, who you know from Yellow Jackets, where she plays Jackie?
I thought that they did a good job casting someone who has an almost anime look to like how gigantic
those
her
huge eyes
are.
Yeah.
And that, you know, she tends to be styled. And like, if you did watch Yellow Jackets, you kind of have that little, you know, little piece of baggage about this actor. But I think that's useful that it's, you know, more of a backpack and it's full of handy things. But I think that she's just enough of a twist on the, like, you know, strong female, like, Tomb Raider thing that you might be expecting.
Yep.
But they don't, again, here's a place where they don't really dwell on what you're expecting versus what they're giving you. And the, like, the horniness helps, but they're also not writing her as, like, a, you know, her strength and capability is not, like, reverse mapped from like a male character. Like sometimes they do that. This is more of like a cop show thing when it's like, you know, this female character is like tough and driven, so we'll just write her like she is a single guy character, and you know, it doesn't exactly work all the time. I thought that she was great casting. I kind of loved the casting of her dad also. I thought that was like solid. They looked alike, but they also had a similar vibe to them. I don't know.
But then there's the brother.
Yeah.
And he looks nothing like the sister. Yeah. Like they cannot be. He is
and
2 foot two.
Even smaller than her. Like what?
It's such a weird casting choice. He doesn't look like the father either. I don't know why we're dancing around who the father is, but it doesn't really matter. You'll find out pretty quick.
Oh, no,
in
we
the
don't
show.
Have to. It's Kyle MacLachlan. Yeah. But, you know.
Weird casting. I thought maybe there was going to be like he wasn't really, you know, he wasn't the biological son, but that doesn't come up. The thing about you're saying about like how she's instantly horny, this is a small, just like dialogue spoiler, not really a plot spoiler. But later in the season, there is a point where she just like asks Maximus, because they're locked in a room together, do you want to have sex? And he's like, never had sex, doesn't really understand it. So he like clinically describes what he like, ooh, that thing where you have to like mush around your penis and then you feel funny and goo comes out of it. He's like, yeah, usually. Oh, I did. That feels weird. It was just like really funny, but it kind of flipped, like what Sarah was saying, like it flipped it, right?
Yeah,
like, you know, it was kind of coded the other way. That was pretty funny. There's a lot of little moments like that.
Like the curtain.
Oh, yeah.
Were you going to mention the curtain from
the pilot.
First episode?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Her new husband is like, seems kind of feral and, you know, maybe a little indoorsy, and like he hasn't been around a lot of people. And that's that whole vault set of characters is like that, except for Mrs. Mandy Patinkin from Homeland, who looks schemey because that's mm-hmm. what she does.
Yeah.
So they the newlyweds have sex, and then he gets up and like wipes his dick off with the curtain.
Yeah.
But they don't make a big show. Like, you could see what he's doing, but they don't make sure that you get it. And her right. response to registering it and then deciding not to give a shit because she's yes. post-coital.
Yeah.
It's good. It's good. And then mm-hmm. all of a sudden it's like, I mean, yeah, I liked the way that I liked the choices they made.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's fun. The second episode, the part that won me over is that there is a fist fight with a bear.
Oh.
There's a robot who fights a bear and they sure. start just duking it out with their fists.
Mm, okay.
A lot of little touches, like in the first episode or maybe the second episode, where we get a little bit of the Maximus backstory, what his deal is, why he ended up in the Brotherhood of Steel. They're basically saying he, Indiana Jones, nuked the fridge. Like, he yes. is shown coming out of the fridge. I thought mm-hmm. that was a cute little thing. Like, this is a very expensive show. It's not high art, but like, put it on the spectrum with Twisted Metal, which I think is probably the closest recent adaptation of this sort, where it's like, it's violent and it's in a future we don't like. Like, this is miles better than mm-hmm. Twisted Metal. And it has a rough start, but it's really fun. And yeah, I just like ate them up. They do fall into some traps because it is a post-apocalyptic universe. The structural integrity of known points of interest are way stronger than anything else.
Yeah.
So when Los Angeles is destroyed, the only things left are the Spider Tower, Control Tower at LAX, Randy's mm-hmm. Donuts in Inglewood, the rest of Inglewood, ash. Randy's Donuts, still there. The Griffith Observatory, still there. Everything around mm-hmm. it, gone. So I enjoy that, where it's like, where can we live? Well, if the Capitol Records building isn't full, I guess maybe try there, because that's the only other place I can think of.
Right. Like, I was going to say, yeah.
And there's when they finally do get to Los Angeles, and it's sort of like a big part of it is flooded, they meet this monster. I forget what it's called. It's like a grabber or something like that. But it's so upsetting. And I'm going to spoil what it is because I just want your reaction to it. So move ahead 45 seconds if you don't want to hear creature details. But it's basically this fish thing that looks like those fancy pets everybody's getting, those salamander with dreads. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oxalotl or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Except when it opens its mouth and it tries to like grab you to pull you in, inside of its mouth, in order to like get you further in, it's just dozens and dozens of human fingers that it's evolved inside of his mouth. And they're all, it was so fucking creepy. And I was like, oh my God, that is such good design. It was so upsetting. I was like, genuinely like, oh, it was like, I had like something in my stomach turned over. And there's more of that to go. And the violence is great. Like, Tara, like, there's not a lot of it in the first episode,
yeah.
but it gets very gushy.
Okay.
So I know how you like your ultra violence.
I was going to ask, on a scale of 1 to The Boys, where we would put this.
It's not as gushy as The Boys. And there's also not as much of it. For instance, there is a scene where the robot suit guy is trying to get the suit back from people that have discovered it powered down. He's trying to get back into it so he can fight. He eventually does. And he's just trying to like get him away from the suit and moving his hands. And he like has his hand half on somebody's head, and he just doesn't really understand the suit that well. So like the motor works a little bit. It just like crushes half the guy's head. Whoa. like a disgusting pot of stews coming out of his head. There's a lot of stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it's not like The Boys, where it's like, you're going to explode in 20 gallons of blood and viscera. Mm-hmm. It's not quite that bad. It's more in the flow of battle and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's right. plenty gross.
Okay.
It's plenty gross.
All right.
And there's also a lot of guest stars in this show. I wasn't expecting mm-hmm. that. I won't say who they are, but there are some ESG faves yet to come for you guys.
I'm sold.
Cool.
Is it the music they play as the bombs are dropping in Fallout? No doubt about it. It also means it's time for a little segment we call Ask EHG. All All right, before we get to your questions this week, we have to deal with last week's Ask EHG. Tara, remind us what that was.
Eric wanted to know, ignoring the fact that it's a stupid idea, who would you cast as the Muppets in a live-action Muppet movie? And Dave reached out to Adam807. This was supposed to be my judging job, but he took it off my plate. And Adam has sent his reaction. So what follows is me reading Adam's comments. So if you're mad, blame him. Honorable mention to Anne with an EEE for pandering to me specifically, meaning Adam, with the Grey's Anatomy characters, Richard as Kermit, Adele as Miss Piggy, Catherine as Denise, who I guess is Kermit's new girlfriend from the show of the Muppets that was sort of like The Office, and George O'Malley as Robin.
Mm-hmm.
Further honorable mention is to PD Exorcist for Jennifer Coolidge as Miss Piggy, John Stewart and Mark Maron as Waldorf and Statler, and to Eric without a K for casting Richard Kind as Muppet Thunderdome runner-up Gorgon Heap. But Adam writes, only one person actually followed the brief, which was to cast the Muppets, plural, and while there are of course too many for this to be practical, only Lucy with a Y put forward a plausible cast. Miss Piggy, Sarah Baker, Kermit, Ben Feldman, Fozzie, Guy Branum, Gonzo, Jason Mantzoukas, Rizzo, Kate McKinnon, Dr. Teeth, Questlove, The Electric Mayhem, The Roots. I think that's more people that are in The Electric Mayhem, but sure. Scooter, Harvey Guillen, Dr. Bunsen Honeydew, Matt Berry, Beaker, Mark Evan Jackson, Statler and Waldorf, RuPaul and Michelle Visage, the Swedish Chef, Bill Skarsgård, the Muppetiest Skarsgård, Sweetums, Dave Bautista, Sam the Eagle, Cheryl Lee Ralph, love it, and Lou Zealand, the guy that puts fish in the cannon, Joe Latrulio. So even yes. though this includes two actors I, Adam, find unwatchable, and not casting the individual Mayhem members is a cop-out, Lucy with a Y is our winner by default, and Ben Feldman and Mark Evan Jackson are brilliant choices. Thank you, Adam.
Mm-hmm.
I've got one of the Mayhem ones I just thought of because it's been in my mind because we got tickets to see Connor O'Malley, who would make a great animal.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Unpredictable and really out there.
Yes.
So we could put him in there. I don't know the rest of them, but I think he would do a good job.
Well, I had a Janice, and it's Kate Hudson, who has long, straight brown hair and seems like a stoner.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also going to give a sticker out to Suli, who Adam mentioned after he already sent me his judgment that he liked that set, too. So, Suli, you as well will get a sticker this week. If you DM me and let me know your mailing address, I will send out one to you as well. All right, let's get to this week's questions. Our first one is from Millsnack. Which show would you like to put a dome over? Which show would you like to put a dome over, Tara?
The Crown, because those people need to be contained. I don't care that it's based on real events. Dome them up, Sarah.
I apologize. Point of order.
Yes.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard.
All right.
At no point in your rambling, incoherent response, were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought? Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to
Domer.
It. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.
Sarah's so out of sync.
It's so
I was like
later.
5 seconds later, dumber.
That was on purpose.
Oh, okay.
I thought that was the point of the exercise.
I was like, is there really that much of a lag? Wow.
We've been having some audio problems recently. All right, Sarah, what do you got for this?
I'd like to put a dome over Extra Hot Great. Just kidding. I picked Veronica Mars. It could be a season mystery, and I think the show's overall noir bent would keep it from getting too, you know, dome. Dave.
Domer. I thought Dukes of Hazzard might be good.
Stealing my bits.
I just think it would be funny if there's like a 50-50 chance that the General Lee would like jump off one of those convenient ramps into an invisible wall. I think that'd be great. That would make the show kind of exciting.
Yep.
Agree.
See Kent is next. What is a TV show you remember cause or not cause playing in your youth? Sarah, you're a kid. You're playing TV. What's happening?
domer. Okay, that's not going to work. I didn't really do this with TV as a kid. I did it with movies. When I was really little, like four, I was obsessed with the underdog theme, and I used to full out run around the first floor of the house with a blanket tied around my neck, yelling it, which my hungover parents just loved, loved it. But other than that, I didn't really do this with TV. Dave?
Yeah, I mean, once Star Wars hit, that was pretty much it. But I'm pretty sure before that, I was doing some $6 Million Man playing, which probably meant there was some Bigfoot content. So that's exciting. Tara?
Okay.
I may have told the story on the podcast before, but I was obsessed with my dream of Genie when I was a kid. And one Halloween, wanted to be Genie for Halloween. And my mother was like, A, inappropriate, and B, it's going to be too cold for you to show your midriff in Saskatchewan in October. So for some reason, this transmogrified into a costume of, and this is what we called it at the time, and it's very inappropriate, but Gypsy, I apologize to everyone. And so that's what I was in, I think, grade two. So sorry, I'm not going to be posting the photos. Please don't retroactively cancel me. It was the 80s. We didn't know. I'm sorry.
Allie Triss is next. And this is how we know that once in a while we get new people into the Discord, because it's time to answer this question again, which is, what is the origin story of 17, the Spread Eagle, and 19? Tara, quickly, if you may.
Number 17, the Spread Eagle, is a line from the Cell Block Tango from Chicago. Go and look it up. It's certainly on YouTube. You can hear the whole song and understand what it is in context. And Na-na-na-na 19 is a song by, I believe, Mike Hardcastle?
Paul
Hardcastle, thank you.
The average age of the enlisted man in Vietnam was 19.
Na-na-na-na-na-na-19. Song that really freaked me out when I first heard it as a kid.
Yeah, I think this might have been in the very first Ask EHG. So if you can go back to when these first started, you might get like a fuller answer with clips and everything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true.
Flame Splash, Make a Warriors Come Out to Play gang by collecting folks from across television. My gang is the Phantoms. They include Maris Crane, Vera Pearson, Ugly Naked Guy, and Bob Sacramento.
Love it.
Tara.
My gang is called Beast Mode, and it's made up of mischievous TV animals. We got Knuckles from Knuckles. Did I come up with this theme because I had a Knuckles screener on while I was answering this? Perhaps.
Okay. Sidebar.
Yeah.
So I read that whoever makes that, Endemol or whatever giant corporation owns that, wants to turn the Sonic universe into its own little television MCU.
Yes.
With everybody in it.
Sure.
Oh, my God. Like, people barely know who Sonic is, and now you have Knuckles.
They got a lot of legit comedy people in this thing. I might be reviewing it for Cracked. It's like Adam Pally is the human lead of this show. Mm-hmm.
This is what I know about Sonic.
Yep.
It's not as good as Mario.
Sure.
And for some reason, this is one of the first, like, people are into some weird shit on the internet, sexualized things.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Sonic, there's like a lot of Sonic porn out there.
Oh, dear.
Oh.
So maybe that's why it's just popular.
Okay, that gives a whole new meaning to the name Knuckles as well. Moving on with my gang. Bugs Bunny, SpongeBob SquarePants. Yes, SpongeBob is an animal, technically. A sea animal, of course. Sextina Awkwafina from BoJack Horseman, the musical artist who brought us the song Get Dat Fetus, Kill Dat Fetus. Obviously, Rigby from Regular Show and whatever animal the Animaniacs are supposed to be. Beast Mode! Sarah.
Hosts, come out and pack your bucket hats and camp shirts and Botany 500 suit pants. The hosts are Jeff Probst, Phil Kogan, Alan Cumming, RuPaul Charles, Tom Bergeron, Nicole Byer, and the restless ghost of Robert Stack.
Ooh, sad news for Joe Manganiello, not included.
Mm-mm.
I was just seeing if the Animaniacs had a Wikipedia entry that actually defined what they were, but they are not. They are undefined. Rodent adjacent, perhaps.
Or whatever kind of, you know, dog Goofy is supposed to be.
Right. Mm. All right. This one is for Sarah. It comes from Ted's, even though that's just one person. I don't want to confuse you. This is not a question from various people named Ted. This is from one person named Ted's.
A murder of Ted's.
Yes. Got it. In a recent Ask EHG answer, Sarah mentioned wanting to make a remake of the series Sports Night. Who would you cast, Sarah, in this Sports Night 2.0?
This took a while because the fantasy casting possibilities were endless and all delightful, and I was sadder after I was finished with my list. But here's what we've got. Lakeith Stanfield and Samira Wiley as Dan and Casey. Archie Punjabi as Dana. Ike Barinholtz and Missy Pyle as associate producers Jeremy and Natalie. Johnny Ray Diaz of Primo as Sal Sasser of West Coast Update. Jason Priestley as Gordon Gage, because why not? And also, he's named Gordon. B.B. Newworth as Isabel Jaffe. And Alec Baldwin, adjudications pending, as Jack Donaghy just transplanted whole cloth from 30 Rock.
Wow.
And our last question comes from L-Triple-B. Name two characters from different series that would be friends. Tara.
Well, keeping in mind a tweet from at Dancing of Pens from May 3rd, 2020, Dancing of Pens wrote, "Lesbians and their himbo straight friends are honestly the best pairing, which is why I have come to this panel with Gloria from Girls 5 Eva and Reacher from Reacher." Dave.
Muscle Man from The Regular Show and Worf from Star Trek.
Yes.
Sarah.
Marshall Flinkman from Alias and Dr. Krieger from Archer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yep. Some bad shit might come out of that.
Yeah, the worst.
All right, it is time for your question, dear listeners. It is Ask EHG. It comes from T. Pickles. Who are the worst characters in the following classic TV show professional arenas? 1, medicine. 2, legal. 3, education. 4, press or media. So, medicine, legal, education, press. Give us your worst characters that are employed in those fields. All 4. That's your answer for next week. Don't make the Muppet mistake again. And no. Just give us one. Give us all 4.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time to discover who is not quite the winner and loser of the week. I have this week's first not quite winner. It is Nicola Coughlan from Bridgerton, who negotiated a clause in her contract in which the production company must supply her with a rated PG version of the show that she could give her parents. That is fucking adorable.
That's cute.
It's really cute.
That is cute.
It puts me in the mind that maybe she goes trick-or-treating and only goes to her parents' house on Halloween, even though she's a grown woman, just to make them smile. Seems like that kind of person. And late breaking news, I'm going to throw in here, Monarch Monsters Incorporated got renewed. So season 2 of that is apparently happening. So good. I'm just going to throw it out there because maybe the stories aren't written yet. What if Kurt Russell drinks something and he becomes as tall as Godzilla and has to fight Godzilla?
Yes.
And not quite loser of the week, Sherlock alumnus Mark Gatiss is writing and starring in a drama about a crime solving bookshop owner, Sarah.
That's why I put it in.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. No, you're not allowed to guess, Tara, because you put it in.
Okay.
What do you think this person's name is, the lead character in this show?
Nigel?
His first name's Gabriel. What's his last name? Don't overthink it.
Angel?
Book.
I don't know.
His name is Book.
No!
He owns a bookstore. His name is Gabriel Book.
Come on! I was thinking like Horn because I actually didn't click through and read it.
Is it called Buy the Book or Throw the Book at Him or Book Him or Sarah's Never Watching That?
I mean, based
don't
on...
ask her.
It's called Bookish.
Ugh.
And his name is Book.
Boo.
Yes, boo indeed.
Boo.
All right, Sarah, what do you got for not quite winner?
The not quite winner of the week on my end is Melrose.
Hey.
It's getting a revival, maybe, with Laura Layton, Heather Locklear, and Daphne Zuniga. And by maybe, I mean they are not denying that they're involved, even though some of their characters are dead. But there's a lot of road between they're trying to revive this and are actually seeing it.
Yeah.
Sub not quite winner is basically everyone who remembers the 2009 reboot, which we're apparently agreeing as a culture to pretend never happened.
Yeah. They're doing a The Conners / Will and Grace where it's like, oh, nothing that happened at the end of the earlier show you remember is actually real. And this is Especially surprising news for Laura Layton, since they killed off Sydney twice. They killed her in the original series and in the 2009 version. So good for her.
She comes back. She's got no nose.
She can't stay down.
Mm-hmm.
We love her.
Yep. She's like running around after a chicken in the background of a shot. Anyway, the not quite loser of the week is that chicken, but also Tim Kring, who's trying to revive heroes again.
No.
No one asked for this. Even Mm-mm. Tim Kring, if he stopped to think about it, would be like, I should get a paper route. But he didn't stop to think about it. He's just heroesing. What is it now? Heroes colon Eclipse?
What if this is a newsroom mistake and these are the same show?
Oh.
It's Melrose Place, but they're all superheroes.
No! Well,
oh, God.
I would watch it.
I would watch it.
Me too.
Tara, who's the not quite winner of the week in your corner?
Our not quite winner is previous Extra Extra Hot Great lead topic, Curb Your Enthusiasm, which hit a season high of 1.1 million viewers for its series finale. Considering it is a premium cable show and that it's the year 2024, those numbers are actually pretty good. So congratulations to Curb. And side note, a lot of people are mad about that finale. I thought it was very charming and I laughed a lot. Dave, you also watched
it. Yeah, I thought it was good.
Our loser, not quite, division is what?
I just love this one. It's the secondary point that I really love.
Okay.
Please explain.
So it's Tulsa King because they had hired a local casting agency to supply them with background actors, aka extras. And that casting agency quit after word got back to them, I guess, that Sylvester Stallone was accused of disparaging the background actors, specifically saying... They were ugly. And the Tulsa King director
always the ugly people.
has denied this report. One background actor who was apparently hired. The issue is they were like, we need extras for the scene that's like at a cool bar. I assume this is the final scene of the first season. And Sylvester Stallone was mad because they were like, didn't look cool enough. And one of them was a little overweight and had a cane. And since that person has been called out, they have responded.
Wow.
And we'll link that in the show notes to be like, you know, well, I was whatever. I'm fat guy with cane. What are you going to do?
At the bar, and I was, you know, when I do this thing and I don't look over at the guy, the kid, it makes me want to throw up in my mouth. I can't act this way.
I am kind of surprised that Sylvester Stallone is even going to be back for season two of the show, because in season one, he did a lot of complaining about, like, doing a TV show is a lot of work, and it is, even for him, who, like, I think did as much of it sitting down as he possibly could. Yeah. But, yeah, Tulsa King, get it together, because I'm anxious for season two. When Reacher is off the air, I need a show of this caliber, meaning mid and violent. And so if there isn't more Tulsa violent. King for this reason, I'll be pissed.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get a coffee. I finally figured out how to order a coffee in this world. And I look over, and there's this guy with a cane. He's got like one pimple. It made me want to barf. What's next?
That's the end.
Well, you missed the beginning, grandpas, of Dave's Sylvester Stallone impression, but I know Dave, and I know that you will not be spared the middle and the end. You also missed our discussion of Fallout, and we talked a lot about your questions, including how I'd recast Sports Night, how we'd assemble warrior gangs, shows we cosplayed as children. The answers to all of that is in the main section of this here podcast. And if you kick up your pledge just a skosh, you can hear all of that. But we are glad that you are here now. Domer. Also, there was some Domer content. You probably
sure
figured
was.
That out.
Yep.
We are glad that you are here now for April Domer.
Mm-hmm.
There's really not that much to this. It is April. I was asked to remove an extra credit topic from my butthole, and this is what we got.
Great.
So three television...
Fantastic.
Buttholey. Three television Aprils will enter...
Let's laugh...
April Dome.
...and forget ourselves.
Yes, Abe. Let's do that. It's not April, though. It's April Dome. Three television Aprils will enter, one will leave. These Aprils are April Kepner of Grey's Anatomy, April Ludgate Dwyer of Parks and Recreation, and April Curtis of Knight Rider. If you don't know who that is, it's the season two Bonnie, when Bonnie was like at kit school for a season.
Bonnie Camp.
Yes, Bonnie Camp. April apparently was sent to a farm upstate after season two. The less said about that, the better. I think that April Curtis of Knight Rider is going to win this face-off. I will explain why, and then I will throw this discussion to my esteemed co-hosts. April Kepner is a doctor. She's good with surgical tools, maybe. She has successfully weaponized whining, if the Grey's Anatomy recaps I used to edit are any indication. And she has the strength of 10, for her heart and pants are pure, or they were up to a certain point. I think she was one of those being a virgin as a personality characters. Not sure. I like Sarah Drew, the actor who plays her, but, you know, April Kepner might be relatable to some, but she is also, I think, going to get killed quite easily. April Ludgate, if these are the actors, I think April Ludgate wins. I'm never betting against Aubrey Plaza, but it isn't. They might have called her Satan's niece on that show, but I think her whole goth deadpan vibe suggests that she's not going to commit to fighting for her life, or at least not in time to save herself, unless that joke bio that she wrote about firing beams of tacos out of her hands wasn't really a joke. Because that's going to be a winner. If it was a joke, though, I think April Curtis wins. She's functionally mission control on an action show, and if I had to pick between the two who had this role on the show, I think Bonnie is, like, better and a bigger bitch also. But April will not back down from Garth. She will always spring to Devin's defense, and she's a big fan of the overlayering styles of the 80s, which means slacks worn with 3-inch pumps that she could bury in an opponent's eye, extra vests to strangle adversaries, and, of course, that big, beautiful cloud of overstyled auburn hair, which will require a big ol' ozone-phobic can of Aquanet to maintain, and that in turn can be sprayed in faces, lit on fire to create fireballs, etc. I don't think Curtis is a great fighter per se, but if the character could stand up to the absolute tsunami wall of water overacting that was David Hasselhoff as Garth, I think the other two are sufficiently not great that she's got a real shot here. I have a clip in support of this position. Dave, would you mind?
Beauty, elegance, and grace. Leave her alone. You remind me of a filly I once owned. Beautiful, spirited, free, and wild. It took me 2 weeks to break her, and I enjoyed every minute of it.
You disgust me. No, no.
No, no. Anyway, Team April over Team Bonnie, and Team April here. Tara, how do you see this playing out?
I agree with you that April Ludgate Dwyer is too apathetic to really engage in her own defense. I do think she might survive by just, like, melting into the scenery while the other two fight each other and just, like, hanging back and texting, which is her normal move on the show. But I think the main fight is going to be between Kepner and Curtis. And the thing about Kepner is, first of all, I truly read the entire Wikipedia page on this character. You are right. She was not only an adult virgin, but one who had sex and then went on to fail the medical boards the next day. She's been fired from Seattle Grace Mercy West two different times and then hired back. She got pregnant and gave birth to a baby that had horrible birth defects and died almost immediately. And even though the baby's father's name was Jackson, they named it Samuel. So come on, guys, Samuel and Jackson in the same family. She, you know, she did serve in the army with the Kevin McKidd character, Owen. So she probably did receive some weapons training. I think she will hang on for a time. But Kepner is a loser in life. She's going to be a loser in the Thunderdome because April Curtis As Sarah said, she's the chief mechanic for Kit. She's an engineer, which means she's a logical thinker and a problem solver. And according to her page on the Knight Rider fandom wiki, Kit thinks of April as a mother figure. And as we've already discussed in our Mom Thunderdome, moms have something to fight for. And no mom has ever had a child as important or wonderful as Kit. So April is going to fight for her life and survive so she can get back to her boy. April Curtis for the win. Dave.
Do you think Kit's like at Thunderdome watching? He's just like outside the grill.
And he's got his headlights on watching.
Just watching. Sure. Yeah.
Of course.
That would give her a boost.
Definitely.
Or he's like jacked into the Thunderdome and can electrify it against April's enemies.
Perhaps. Mm.
No. The board would never allow him to. Domer. I think you're giving Parks and Rec April short shrift here. I think she is at heart a stone cold killer when she needs to be. The thing is that she doesn't usually want to be because it takes effort. But here we are in the Thunderdome. If you're going to be an effortful psycho killer, now's the time. And I think she could probably pull it out if she needed to and do it. So I like the Kit argument and I love the fact that Kit has a mom. But April from Parks and Rec is kind of scary, and I think she might do it. So she's going to get my vote. Let's put this to the vote. It's very exciting. All right, Sarah, you are saying
Curtis.
Tara, you are saying.
I'm saying Curtis too.
All right. Well, then it doesn't matter, does it? So Curtis takes April Dome. Well, that is it for another episode of Extra, Extra Hot Grate. We saved our discussion of Amazon's adaptation of Fallout for the Extra, Extra Hot Grate Vault before answering your burning Ask EHG questions like, where's that dome going and who are you cosplaying? We celebrate those who work quite the best and worst of the week and wrap it all up with April Dome. Next up, it's America's most famous fucking founding father, Ben Franklin, and he's coming to Apple TV and he's... gonna fuck you. Remember.
We're listening.
I am David Tickle, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Okie dokie,
oh, and Sarah D. Bunting.
Domer.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra, Extra.
Not great.
Well, I may play a hero in the movies, but you all are heroes in real life. And now you can be a hero, too, by purchasing a residence in a Vault-Tec vault today. Because if the worst should happen tomorrow, the world is going to need Americans just like you to build a better day after.
And cut.
This is Extra Hot Grate Minis. Today's topic is sympathy for the devil.
Welcome to another week of Extra Hot Grate Minis. Joining us all this week are Eve Beatty and Tim Ahalt. Hello.
Hi.
Howdy.
Today's extra credit topic comes from Suli, who writes, choose a villain or evil cabal from a TV show for whom or which you've always had sympathy, and try to convince the Extra Hot Grate listener we should agree with your way of seeing things. I'm going to go first because it's important. Mine is Gus Fring of Breaking Bad. And here's why. He is a pillar of the Albuquerque community, active in many causes. He's a superlative manager of people. He's an innovator in the field of organizational efficiency. He always, I hate the phrase, but when it comes to thinking outside the box, he does. He brings a very unsentimental attitude to the workplace, and he understands that drug prohibition policies are racist and is basically just engaged in elaborate civil disobedience. There, I said it. Tim.
My vote is for Margot Martindale's character, Unjustified. Just think of it.
Megs Bennett.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Going to someone's, I forgot who said it at their point. When she says nothing ever changes, and you know, we could say all these bad things she's doing and she's looking out for herself. But ultimately, that kind of stuff really does trickle down the community. And you think she's this ultimate, villain, which she is in a way, but you see the softer side come out when she's tending to her who she thinks could have been her daughter. And I always had a soft spot for her for that reason.
All right, Eve.
So, hi, everybody. My name's Arvin Sloan, and it's time you heard my side of things. Everyone is all boo-hoo. You killed Sydney Bristow's fiancé. But as I told her when she oh so unprofessionally came storming into my office after the deed was done, she knew that would happen if she spilled the beans. And anyway, would things have worked out with Danny in the long run? She was clearly meant to be with Vaughn, and you could argue, and I am, that I brought them together. If you think about it, Sydney should be thanking me. And while we're on Sydney, it's like, come on. You're supposed to be some super chosen, awesome spy, kick-ass grad student, but you don't have the critical thinking skills to realize you're totally not in the CIA. You're flying fucking coach to your spy assignments, for Pete's sake, and you're never doing things in any country that's part of the U.S. global security agenda. It's a post-9/11 world, and we're chasing artifacts like we're Hitler or something. You've never once said, hey, shouldn't we be looking for bin Laden instead of this big red ball? Let's face it. I was doing that dumb bunny Sydney Bristow a favor by giving her a job where she got to work out, wear cool outfits, and go to numerous awesome international clubs. You can send your apology for branding me a villain to that weird tomb I'm still buried in. I'll be waiting forever.
Dave.
My choice is The Network from the UK show Utopia and other countless evil altruistic organizations from TV and movies that all seek to save the human race by killing a very large portion of it.
Yep.
The reasons why you may want to support organizations such as The Network are lack of resources as our population grows,
yep.
The need to have a mindset reset and have a culture that is less things-oriented and more people-oriented. And frankly, people are having just too many kids nowadays. So it's time for another global pandemic to thin out their ranks.
Thank you.
Yeah. Networks from Utopia.